You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Mark Kickford for the past 2 hours. His first time behind a live mic for Saturday's Too Good to Be Forgotten. But now at noon, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly wander around the garden of latest cinema releases. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Sarah McIntosh.
Hello.
Yossi Osman.
Hello.
And Jack Toy.
Buongiorno.
The films up for review over the next hour all concern themselves with secrets and lies. The Imitation Game, which unpicks the life of Alan Turing, the code-breaking genius whose wartime work counted for so little when his sexuality was brought into question. A beautiful Parisian apartment becomes a theatre for shocking family revelations in My Old Lady. And Cannes winner Winter Sleep carefully dissects, over a three-hour-plus running time, the fallacies and facades of a man. Plus, we've two interviews that throw some light on how the cinema experience is changing. We talk to Ian Cartwright of R-Screen, which offers a chance to book your own choice of film into your own local cinema. And we catch up with the two students behind the Cambridge Boutique Cinema Club, which painstakingly designs an immersive cinematic evening. That's all got to be fitted in the next 56 or so minutes, so we'd better get cracking.
Gentlemen, meet Mr. Turing.
We were to work together then. I'm afraid these men would only slow me down.
Popular at school, were you?
We're short on staff.
We get more staff then. You have 6 minutes to complete the task.
Is anything possible?
No, it takes me 8.
5 minutes and 34 seconds.
You said to do it in under 6. What is it that we're really doing?
We were going to break an unbreakable Nazi code and win the war.
You know, to pull off this irascible genius routine, one actually has to be a genius.
I'm designing a machine that will allow us to break every message, every day, instantly.
You're going to need all the help you can get, and they are not going to help you if they do not like you.
Have you decrypted a single German message?
You will
never understand the importance of what I am creating here!
Our patience has expired.
No!
Now that winter is finally here, cinema has ditched a blockbuster for the cosy warmth of the biography of a difficult man. We've just had Mike Leigh's effervescent Mr. Turner. Stephen Hawking is the subject of the soon-to-be-released Theory of Everything. And whilst new release, The Imitation Game, carries itself as a thriller, its real aim is to get under the skin of the brilliant, persecuted mathematician Alan Turing. Adapted by screenwriter Graham Moore from a variety of sources, The Imitation Game threads together several key events in Turing's life. We see him at boarding school, where he's bullied for his cleverness and where his first homosexual crush introduces him to the joy of solving impossible puzzles. The film contrasts this with the older Turing, played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Post-war, he is hounded by the police for his sexuality, but the bulk of the film takes place in the grounds of Bletchley Park, where, between 1939 and 1944, the brilliant Turing led a team trying to do the impossible and crack the German Enigma coding machine. Jack, to come to you first, but I know everybody in the room has seen it. The Imitation Game has a lot on its plate. It has to tell the story of a complicated man, a very complicated man, in an accessible manner for a sort of Friday night crowd, art house crowd. Does it manage to be both thought-provoking, get across the abstract nature of what Turing was involved with, and be an audience pleaser?
Well, yes, I think so. I'm going to draw us back to the Toronto Film Festival this year when Imitation Game and Theory of Everything premiered, and our head programmer, Claire Binns, liked both of them but preferred Theory of Everything, and so did most of the film reviewers, most of the critics, most of the programmers. Yet the Imitation Game won the Audience Award, the best film there, and I think this is what we're seeing critically. It's maybe not as well received as Theory of Everything might be, but in terms of bums on seats, it's just drawing in.
I got the name from somewhere.
Yeah. So I think it's striking a chord particularly with the Cambridge audience, with the fifth highest box office for the film in the whole of the UK.
The Arts Picture House is. We should point out that you're marketing manager for the Arts Picture House when you're not, you know, obeying my every word.
Yeah. And also interesting to see Benedict Cumberbatch in, again, another kind of hard to grapple with role, but it's actually drawing in the audiences because, of course, he played Julian Assange in The Fifth Estate. No one really liked that film. And again, he's kind of like an outsider character who's working with kind of state secrets in this one, but people love it. So I don't know what the code is there to crack. Oh, sorry.
Sarah, Jack has mentioned there that it is making big box office numbers at the picture houses all over the country, independent cinemas and multiplexes all around the country. It's got a lot of press attention. It will have some Oscar success, possibly. Does it do that and remain true to the spirit of Turing, or does it become too generic a film, or is that a price you have to pay for telling this particular story?
I do think there is an issue in that it does kind of it is a bit oversimplified, and it's a sufficient film. For me it was sufficient. The thing that made it a little bit more than just that were the performances. I don't know that I know enough about Alan Turing to say whether or not, you know, it's any kind of. I don't think it was particularly in depth. It all seemed quite on a fairly sort of superficial-ish level. But, you know, people like actors like Benedict Cumberbatch in that role, and the young lad who plays the younger version of Turing, Alex Lawther, they're absolutely superb in those roles. And it is, you know, all film is manipulative. In this film is particularly emotionally manipulative in a way. But I was okay to go with that. And, you know, yes, it was nothing spectacular narrative-wise. But, you know, when it wanted you to cry, I cried. And when it wanted you to be on the edge of your seat, I was, you know... I was actually kind of quite, anxious at the right places.
But is it coming to you, Yossi? Does it? It is tense. It is manipulative in a mild way, as Sarah just hinted at. But is it the course this story should have taken? It has taken years for. It's taken decades for there to be a royal pardon for Turing's persecution and chemical castration. After the way he was treated after the war in the 1950s, it's taken years for that royal pardon. Is this the way to tell this important and vital story of intelligence and of persecution? Or is it, again, too generic, too trying to be theme park history?
I think I'm in agreement with Sarah on a lot of what she said. I'm not an expert on Alan Turing at all, but part of me was quite disappointed at the end of the film. I did enjoy it, I did really like it, but I was quite disappointed at the end of the film because I wanted more, really. I felt like there was a lot more about this man that the film just didn't go into. I don't know, I felt a little bit underwhelmed. And yes, I do think it was quite simplified. I think generic is the word to use, really. But in saying that, you know, it's a crowd pleaser. I was in a packed screening at the Picture House. Everybody was laughing in the right places.
That's nice. It's a story that needs laughing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was enjoyable. And I did really like it, but I wanted a bit more substance, I think.
But I do think, like, maybe the focus was the wrong focus, like, maybe that it was somehow sort of trying not to upset the status quo as far as, you know, the government and their what they did to him. Maybe perhaps the focus should have been more on post-war Alan Turing. As much as what he did during the war was amazing and fantastic.
There are two separate films here, as you've hinted at, the scenes when Turing's a boy are some of the best in the film, mostly due to the young actor. They don't serve a huge narrative point except for callbacks, which I found rather falsified anyway. They wrap everything up in a nice, neat narrative bow. And I'm getting a little bit tired of these of complicated men and women being tied into neat narrative bows by cinema. He was a brilliant, difficult, complicated man, and why should it be turned into a button pushing, a film that pushes all the right buttons at the right moment? Why should there be a bit of laughter? Why should there be a bit of tension? Why should there be this urge to make it hit all the necessary plot beats? Because in the end, it becomes less important as a document, less valuable as a document of Turing's life, I feel.
I guess the Weinstein Company know what they're doing with regards to those... Sorry, I'm leaning back. With regards to those hitting all the different emotional points in the film. So, as I understand it, the film has gone through quite a few edits to portray Turing in the way that it does.
Does it soften his homosexuality? Again, I don't want... It's not about that until it wants to be about that. Mm. And then when it wants to be about that, it pussyfoots around it a little bit, simply by having... Let's concentrate on the scenes in the 1950s when he's being... when he lines up being persecuted, which is one of the most horrible examples of bureaucracy and prejudice post-war. And then you have him being brought in on a different charge. You end up with a sympathetic police officer, which is nonsense, and you end up with him in a police cell, Turing, the older Turing, in a police cell, telling this sympathetic police officer, who's played by the great Rory Kinnear, telling this police officer his whole story. That did not happen.
No.
And that's it's and if you're making that up, that makes me want to believe that everything else is made up. How much else are you twisting and distorting to make sure you hit the comic beat, you hit the sad beat, that you manipulate the audience?
It's not a documentary, though, isn't it?
No. That doesn't wash.
It's a feature film.
Yes, but it's you get to a point at what point, though, Jack, does it become? Does the history have to be... you're right, it's not a documentary, but at what point does the history become too debased for it to be valuable as a film, to be anything? Is Turing suitable for this sort of theme park ride, this roller coaster, to being turned into a historical roller coaster? It almost slips the chemical castration under the wire. See him commit suicide. We have little... nifty little bits of foreshadowing, like, oh, he's brought everybody apples. Oh, we know what that means. But we're not going to show what he did because that's too harsh for the audience. And we're not going to dwell on his homosexuality except when he's a child and it's unthreatening.
I totally agree with you, because one of the things that disappointed me the most, actually, was those sequences in the 1950s, I didn't feel the sense of injustice at what happened to him was there at all.
No, I
really wanted more, and I was quite annoyed that they didn't deal with it in the way I think it should have been dealt with. I don't know if that lessens it as a film as such, because at the end of the day, I think the producers just want to draw the audiences in, which they have done. But for me personally, it's kind of done a disservice to Alan Turing. I wanted more from that, and it just wasn't there.
I think Sarah, do you feel that this is... I'm sure everybody went into this film, and I know the actors did, and Benedict Cumberbatch is very good. Everybody's very good at it, even if they're playing stock characters.
Yeah.
Everybody gives their all, and the screenwriter, Graham Moore and Anthony Hodges, they've given very good interviews about wanting the film to be truthful to the legacy of Turing. But does it get too caught up with being a period piece? All the clothes in the film look brand new. We keep cutting back to the wars to remind the audience. I know there's a sort of ticking clock with them trying to solve Enigma and saying, oh, more people die every minute if you don't solve this. Again, that's a falsification, and it's a falsification that's underlined by, oh, by the way, this is what the Blitz looked like.
Yeah.
This is what German bombers looked like. We know all of this.
Mm.
And it just felt like, again, it was trying to be a period. It felt too much like a period piece, but speaking with an oddly modern voice.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if I have much to say on it, but yes, I agree.
I mean, it brings... it's Joan Clark, the character that Keira Knightley plays, the cut glass accent you can hear in the trailer. She's fine. I have nothing against Keira Knightley. I don't know why people dislike her. She seems to be an adventurous actress.
Yeah, to be honest, I was mildly impressed by her.
I
only noticed her gritting her teeth once.
Is that why she's disliked? Excessive teeth gritting.
Yeah. She wasn't pouting a lot either. She normally pouts quite a bit, but she's slowing that down.
Well, it's not so much that it's, you know, I mean, yes, it's irritating that she does that, but it's that it takes you out of the character. And in this, I wasn't taken out of the character.
But did you find that I don't know, I found she's a fantastic Joan Clark's a fantastic character in her own right. You could make a film about her. You could make a film about her relationship with Turing, where she was unfazed by his revelation of homosexuality.
Perhaps they were trying to put too much into one film.
Well, it's the fact that she speaks with this modern voice. She speaks like she is given the dialogue of a feminist from the 70s or the 80s. And I'm sure she would have held those beliefs, and she was in a difficult situation as a woman at the time, but you don't give her a modern voice, and then suddenly it then turns Turing into a proto-feminist as well, with his little speech that sometimes, you know, the unexpected comes from the, or what is needed comes from the unexpected, the most unexpected of people, which he says to her.
I'm sure there must have been women speaking like that. This is after the suffragettes. That's a bit off to say that there wouldn't have been any women in the 40s that could have been capable of.
Oh, of course they could have been. They could have been, but the
different dynamic of relationship.
But her dialogue and a lot of other dialogue is always couched in this modern language. It just felt like it didn't have. It had a tinier for the period. It's I'm sure she.
Well, it's RP, but I don't know if it's modern. I don't really speak like that, my dear.
It's. I don't know. I just felt there was a danger of homilies being sort of all tying it up a little bit. Too neatly, but I'm focusing too much on the negative. Let's bring it back to the acting, which I think is the main positive.
Brilliant.
Benedict Cumberbatch has got a difficult job in rather unfairly he's been pigeonholed. I think you and I, Sarah, know him from radio, where he's actually quite funny on radio. Well, that seems to have been forgotten. He's a good comic actor. He's just known as Sherlock Holmes, but he has to play a different form of that. Not Asperger's, that's lazy journalism, but that sort of difficult difficult to grasp personality that he has with Holmes, but he has to really dial it down. Does he succeed in creating somebody that's both unapproachable but the willing centre of a movie? Yossi, I'm looking at you.
Yes. The answer is yes. I think he's brilliant in it, and he really carries the film, in my opinion. Benedict Cumberbatch at the moment, he is man of the moment, isn't he? But, you know, I watched that film and I just wanted to see more of him. And actually also props to, is it Alex Lawther, who plays the younger Alan Turing as well? Also absolutely fantastic. I want to see more of him.
With his little Princess Diana eyes. Did that little glance upwards.
Oh, I know, I know. But Benedict Cumberbatch, I mean, I was expecting lots from him and those expectations were met. I think he does Turing very, very well. He's very good at those kind of socially awkward roles, isn't he? And he was just playing to his strengths, really.
I don't know if Smog is a socially awkward role.
I'm a dragon, get me out of here.
He's doing that sort of socially awkward role, but it didn't, to me, I mean, you know, I didn't find it at all caricature, and that was what I was waiting for. I was waiting for it to turn into, you know, some kind of caricature, but I think, you know, it was very nuanced, and I think he did wonderfully.
Do you think there's a... I'm trying to stay on the positives, but I don't have very many. I'm sorry. You have to hit me. You have to give me positives.
Fight it, Toby, fight it.
Yes, sorry. I try not to turn into...
Did you enjoy it? Because it's an enjoyable film. I
no,
think.
I didn't enjoy it at all.
That's a shame.
I didn't expect to enjoy it very much because I didn't like the director, Morten Tudum, who made Headhunters.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really rate Headhunters very much.
Oh, I love that film.
But Headhunters is a much, much better directed film than Imitation Game is, and much better in tone and style. But I wasn't very excited. I think I wasn't very excited by the choice. But I think it lost me at the scene where he goes for the job interview with Charles Dance, who's our mustache twirling villain. When we're not cutting away to shots of Germans and bombers, and one minute they're talking around the job. They're going, and it's clever. So it wound me up there because, again, it didn't feel real. It felt like an easy introduction to our bad guy and our good guy. And then and then after one revelation, they're in an office and they're all talking about Enigma out in the open. That didn't happen. They didn't talk like that. And then they go to a cafe and they talk about Enigma out in the open. It kept doing, for me, I wanted to like it, but as soon as I realised, it's going to be playing to the gallery the whole way through. And then I think it's summed up by the fact that it ends with a credit. This is a film about a man who was chemically castrated and killed himself because of persecution. It doesn't end with that. We don't even see that, as we've discussed. It ends, that section of history ends with Keira Knightley repeating lines to Alan Turing that she's had earlier. Lines that make no sense when they're directed at Turing. And then we end with them laughing around the bonfire as they burn the secret documents. And then it comes up and says, the text on the bottom says, the devices that he worked on his devices for years to come, we now call them computers. I mean, that's Tickle Me Elmo simplicity. That I found that genuinely offensive. And I think to make a film that is about as brilliant a man as Turing as a picture book, it felt like a children's film to me. Mm. A lot of the time, it felt like a children's film. And that sort of simplicity.
There have been similar films. I can't think of. This is ringing bells to me. There's been similar films that have done the same sort of thing as sort of, you know, made it simplified something very complex. But in that, and as well as in this, I come up with the same line, is that who other than, you know, I mean, some of us will have heard of Alan Turing before this film, but. You know, at least perhaps the saving grace is always going to be the fact that, you know, it's making his name known and people are going to go away and find out if
then,
more.
Yeah, there is that to cling to. It's not an evil film. If it does that, if it just does that, then it's doing something good.
Interestingly, Charles Dance on the red carpet for the film when it showed in London at the film festival said... he always thought it strange that the government gave Alan Turing a pardon. He said it should have been the other way around, that it should have been Alan Turing, or at least Alan Turing's family, that pardoned the government for what they did.
I'm not sure the government did give a pardon. It's a royal pardon, so it comes from the Queen. It's separate from the government.
Well, it was only last year.
Yes.
Probably misquoting very slightly, but the sentiment stays the same.
That's it. Okay. All right. Well, we better wrap up. I'm getting into the habit of dragging these first reviews out, which is a bit of a shame. Anyway, The Imitation Game opened last week, and it is playing at all three Cambridge cinemas. And as Jack has pointed out, it is breaking box office records and performing very well. Indeed, it is a certificate 12A. The last couple of years has seen cinema twisting and turning itself to catch the gaze of a changing and fickle audience. Community cinemas are on the increase. The hugely successful Screen Arts programme brings the West End to the provinces, while secret cinema builds whole interactive worlds around popular favourites. But one of the most interesting developments has been the work of R-Screen, an ingeniously simple notion to turn the audience into film programmers. Visitors to the R-Screen website will find a rich database of movies, about 250 at the moment. It can then be arranged to book a screening of one of these films at your nearest participating cinema. Once programmed, you can either invite friends and family to a private screening, or you can ask R-Screen to make the showing public. If enough tickets sell, then the screening goes ahead. Recent successes have included Terry Gilliam's barely distributed by normal means, Zero Theorem, and low-budget UK drama Northern Soul, which has been a smash hit almost entirely off the back of R-Screen showings and is still enjoying cinema screenings despite it being available on DVD. I spoke to Ian Cartwright, co-founder of R-Screen, about their company's work over the past year and a bit. I asked about the success of Northern Soul and how they chose the films that make up their 250-film collection. But I began by asking Ian about the notion behind the brand.
Welcome to People Powered Cinema. Our screen gives you access to hundreds of great films, the best cinemas in town, and all at a time that works for you.
Where our screen came from is there's myself and a gentleman called David Kapoor, and we're co-founders and directors for a company called 1155. And that company set up to support the film industry. And we work a lot with brands and film partners to look at the connection between audiences and film. And one of our clients was the cinema chain, which was Picture House Cinemas. And for those guys, we're tasked with looking at new ways to engage with audiences and bring audiences into cinema. We always look at trends outside of cinema and see if we can bring those into cinema and help more people watch more films on the big screen. One trend that we saw prevalent in every other media out there was on demand, and people could choose when they wanted to watch, what they wanted to watch. But cinema was still very much programmed in the same way it's been programmed for many years. There's people that are programmers and film bookers that go and watch films, and they decide what's played in our local cinemas, what date it's played, and also what time it's played. We thought it could be really interesting for audiences to engage in that process. At the same time, also seeing a huge amount of growth of social media and people having a voice and people being able to move their own audiences and their own community groups, things like Kickstarter, things like Demand It, etc., all sort of inspired thinking around our screen.
There's still a desire to see films that many of these people have already seen, but on a big screen and in a community.
I think there's definitely an audience out there that appreciate that big screen experience, that shared experience of cinema. I think the role of cinema will definitely change over the next few years, but I still think there's a lot to be said of the experience. Going to the cinema and watching on a huge screen, amazing sound, and that being a shared experience, I still think there's a huge place for that and a huge audience out there. And what we're finding is, both within the industry and with our screen, is just the event nature of cinemas kind of coming back. Going to the cinema in itself is an event, but I think because people have done it so much, it's lost that particular sort of event nature. With things like alternative content, the Met Opera, Monty Python, live comedy shows, live gigs being beamed into cinema for one night only, the event side of cinema, I think, is really coming back. And what we're finding with our screen is, when audiences are getting together in the cinema, as opposed to sitting in four different corners of the cinema away from other people in the big screen experience, they're all congregating in the middle of the auditorium, knowing that everyone there has made this screening happen. And I think that sort of community event side of cinema is really interesting. And with examples of Billy Elliot was recently a live broadcast of Billy Elliot, the theatre show was beamed into cinema and grossed about £2 million at the box office. I think with more and more, that's one night only, took more money at the box office than every other feature film that was being played in cinema that evening. I think this event side of cinema is a really interesting area and will continue to grow.
Your public profile has been raised this year by the success of Northern Soul, which wasn't able to find a distributor when it was made. Or during production, found its way to our screen. Were you surprised at the success it had? And did it demonstrate how strong the model was?
I think it definitely demonstrated how strong the model was. It was probably in our mind when building our screen, it was for films like that. It was films that had an audience, had a clearly defined audience, had great dialogue and great communication with their audience. But just for whatever reason, cinema programmers, cinema bookers had a different idea, and they maybe didn't believe there was an audience or didn't believe that there was a route to engaging that audience. And I think where our screen worked really well for everyone involved, so the filmmaker, Elaine, the distributors, Universal, and ourselves, our screen, was it allowed all of those parties to showcase to cinemas across the UK that there was an audience and this audience would buy tickets.
You mentioned that cinema is becoming much more of an event, but do you think that our screen could become a third tier of cinema exhibition? So you have the blockbusters and you have the video on demand. There's still a lot of films that fall between the cracks, and our screen's a good way of catching those and making sure that there's an opportunity to see them, or to provide an opportunity for films that you've only seen on video on demand.
I think it provides an opportunity for films that have an audience to now allow them to create their own cinematic release. the filmmaker themselves can set up the screening. If they have enough critical mass to hit threshold, then the screening then happens. We're working very much with the industry and want it to be a tool that the industry engages with and uses. We think interesting areas are films like Northern Soul that have an audience, but maybe the industry buying initially is not so big, but this allows to prove to the industry that there is an audience for their film. And also, I think the sort of promotional tools that Our Screen could use, even for some of the bigger films, you could imagine having, I don't know, a film like Birdman comes out and you say, we've got a limited number of preview screenings that are available for this film. We've only got 10 prints available. The UK, people across the UK, you can decide where these screenings happen. So then that creates a lot of marketing noise around the film. It also creates a hotspot of the UK of where there's demand for the film, which again is really useful for the industry to then use to sell back into cinema chains. So hopefully we see it as a tool that can work with the industry and allow them to identify audiences and engage with those audiences as well.
To go back to the platform itself, would you be able to tell me how you've arrived at the mix of films that you have on offer? You've got nearly 250, I believe. It's a mix of documentaries, a lot of documentaries, a lot of very new releases, films this year. I believe it was either yourself or your business partner said in a previous interview, we want films that have an energy behind them.
The content that we've got on there at the minute, we've consciously limited the number of content. So we've probably got access to about 10,000 films, but we don't want that sort of Netflix factor where you're blinded by choice in a way. What we wanted to do is try and pick films that we believe there would be an engaged audience behind and audiences that would be able to mobilize other audiences to actually create screenings. As a platform, we want to be quite agnostic about content. For us, it could be a Lars von Trier film. It could be Mamma Mia for a Hindu. For us, it's about enabling people to watch whatever film you want to watch or whatever content you want to watch on the big screen in a cinema environment. It is our goal. But the choice of films at the minute is around what we believe there'll be engaged audiences around. Oh, we're very much open to requests, and we've had requests come in. People have got in contact, people who wanted to arrange a private screening for their mother and father. It was their 60th birthday, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was their favourite film. They got in contact with us. We were able, with relationships we have, to get that film, and a screening was held where this couple went down and watched their favourite film on the big screen all to themselves. What a fantastic birthday present that was for those guys.
Great talk of revolution and a great chance of dead bodies. German soldiers, camps, confusion.
Cambridge hasn't got a screening of the new Godard. I know 10 or 11 people that are rather cross about that, and that it's going straight to DVD. Is that something that in the future our screen, you know, how would we go about it? I know it's that in itself is not on your list, but if there was enough clamouring for it, would something like that be possible?
Yeah, 100%. The reason why we have access to that much content is just from the distributors that we speak to that have got huge catalogues of titles. We're very much at the minute wanting to make sure the titles that we take on are successful, things happen around them. We don't just want thousands of titles that just sit there and nobody does anything with. But by all means, yeah, if there's particular films, lots of people get in contact with us about particular films. And all we do is sort of not challenge them, sort of say, okay, well, who is your community? How are you going to activate this community to get screening? So it's, I don't know, I have a film society of 20 people together. They've all confirmed they want to see the film as well. And a request like that is really simple. It's a case of phoning up the relevant rights owner, letting them know there's an audience there, and we take that to the distributor, source the content, and then screenings are set up and hopefully successful.
You're democratizing cinema in a way.
For us, what we're really proud of is it's a new story to engage people with cinema, and actually hopefully it might get a lot of people back to the cinema that maybe had stopped going to the cinema. And actually I think for a certain audience out there, the idea of organising a private screening for you and your friends to watch films is really quite exciting. And also for lots of film fans or wannabe curators or want to be cinema programmers, you can actually now test your mettle to see if you can pick the right films and if you can engage an audience.
And share with your friends. If enough of us book tickets, your screening happens.
when we've been working on the concepts of it for around sort of 3 years now, and initially when we first took it to cinema programmers, we were petrified and we thought, actually, are they going to view this as a threat? What they've all done is they've really embraced it, and there's been lots of films that they'd love to play in their cinema but simply don't have the space, or there's other film product that take priority. They can now, and Northern Soul's a great example, they can now sort of test the market for it in a way, which I think is really nice, and I think is great for everyone involved, that you can now prove there is an audience for a film.
The cinema is yours. Our Screen. People-powered cinema.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Ian Cartwright for being so generous with his time. You can find out more about Our Screen via their website, www.ourscreen.com. There you'll discover a long list of films available for hire and notice of all the participating cinemas, a list which includes our own Arts Picture House. Don't forget, if you want more film reviews and interviews, then once a month on Cambridge 105, it broadcasts The Eclectic Light Show with Mandy Morton and Nicola Upson, which covers theatre and books and movies. The next show is Sunday, the 14th of December at 2 p.m, and there's a show on Listen Again, which you can access via the Cambridge 105 website, which is www.cambridge105.fm. Anyway, their last show, which is available to listen again, has an interview with Timothy Spall about the excellent Mr. Turner. I also need to point out that there is a screening being arranged in a couple of weeks from the team from Polish Waves, Cambridge 105's long-running Polish language programme. They are showing 2009's Polish horror The Dark House on December the 3rd, which is a Wednesday at 7:45 as part of the Polish Film Club. It's free admission, so everybody can go along. You don't just simply have to be Polish. Free admission, and it's in the William Mong Hall, the William Mong Hall of Sydney Sussex College. Also, very quickly, 27th of September, November, 27th of November, there's Cinema on the Cellar, which is being set up by the people behind the Strawberry Shorts, which is usually on at the Arts, which is on at Strawberry Fair, but is also on at the Picture House Bar. Cinema on the Cellar is a collection of superb award-winning short films from all around the world. It's on the 27th. It is at 8 o'clock, I believe, and it is £3 on the door. So lots and lots to go to see. Still lots to go in the next 25 minutes or so of the programme. We will have an interview with the Cambridge Boutique Cinema Club and a review of Winter Sleep. But before all of that, we're dealing with an unexpected guest.
I inherited this apartment from my father.
This apartment is a Viager. The buyer must pay a fee until the seller dies.
Until you die?
Until I die.
French woman can live a long time.
Yes, it's the red wine, isn't it?
Take a walk by the Seine and please don't jump in. You'll probably fail to drown yourself and just end up with a dreadful cold.
Do you have anything for a headache?
I have spent my whole life at your side. I have never left you.
I never asked for that.
I don't have a friend in the world. Except for this apartment, I have nothing.
You have life left. There is no greater wealth.
So beautiful.
I'm not beautiful. I'm nearly old.
Perfect flower is nearly old.
When it comes to the end of days, Hollywood may find itself held to account for never really giving Kevin Kline enough to do. A brief star after his Oscar win for A Fish Called Wanda, he seems to have spent the last two decades voicing animated sequels and playing befuddled fathers. But new release, My Old Lady, finds Kline in a rare starring role. He plays Matthias Gold, a down-on-his-luck writer who, after a half a lifetime in New York, suddenly finds himself the ugly American abroad, when his estranged father wills him the deed to a sprawling Parisian apartment. But the desperate Gold discovers the property isn't empty. Rather, still rattling around its rambling rooms is the current tenant, Madame Gerard, played by Maggie Smith. A baroque French law means that Matthias can't inherit until the 92-year-old Miss Gerard dies, and matters are further complicated by the arrival of her legally-minded daughter, played by Kirsten Scott Thomas, who will do anything to save the apartment being demolished for a hotel. Sarah, that sounds fairly generic in a sort of romantic comedy type of way. It shows my ignorance of theatre, of which this is an adaptation, that it's not a frothy romantic comedy at all.
No, well, I think there's a really interesting thing going on in the marketing of films the last few years, sort of almost a misrepresentation It's happened before in other films, and I kind of think, well, maybe they're trying to get people in, but not necessarily, under false pretenses in a way, just so that they have the numbers. Because, there was certainly a sense of going in expecting this to be sort of some kind of Le Marigold Quartet weekend. And, for the first 20 minutes, that's kind of what you get. But there is a sudden shift with a certain revelation, and after that everything changes.
Tell me more about this idea you have for the Quartet Marigold Hotel. That sounds like it would run for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Well, as I said, it's kind of this thing where they're tapping into a certain market, and they've seen certain films do particularly well.
You think
they've created the trailer around that premise rather than be honest about what it's about, so that people can make informed decisions about whether
it does seem from the trailer to be a cynical grab for the Grey Pound.
Yeah,
I think they rather insultingly call it.
That said, I'm not necessarily saying that it's, I feel, I actually was, it's not a totally unpleasant surprise to go in and find that this wasn't what this film was. Although I do have problems with the sort of adaptation of theatre, I do find that a lot of the time there's a sort of distancing element because of it. And particularly the playwright is actually also the director.
Israel Horovitz, yes, it's his long-running play,
it's
which is adapted.
He's written the adaptation, and then he's directed it. I think that perhaps that's somehow problematic, because you have these very verbose, almost monologues that are beautiful, they are raw, and they are heart-wrenching, yet. Because, you're kind of still removed a little bit from their full emotion. And I wonder whether that's because, the playwrights are so hypnotised by the language that they've come up with that it gets in the way of any kind of, true verisimilitude, sort of, true connection with the film.
Jack, what about you? You said found it rather sort of a touching film. I mean, this is a film about a family breaking up, not people coming together.
I saw it on, say, like day six for me of the London Film Festival, by which point you've seen a lot of films, so they have to be fairly good to stand out. And I really enjoyed watching it. I think in your list, Sarah, it's closer to Le Weekend than the other two films, because Le Weekend was quite a melancholy, argumentative film, which still managed to be... quite touching.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it to be like that, again, based on the trailer.
No, I think, the middle section is, like, really fascinating and interesting, but it's kind of bookended by these kind of...
Well, that's perfectly true. I hadn't noticed that, yes.
Fluffy kind of, I don't know. I think it lets
it
the film
you,
down.
Do you, without telling everybody what the resolution exactly is, do you feel it earns that resolution?
No.
You've got like the mother-daughter relationship between Christian Scott Thomas and Maggie Smith, and then the father-son relationship between Kevin Kline and his absent father, and how much he's been messed up by him.
Yeah,
and you really invest a lot in their characters, don't you?
I just found it a little bit too tidy at the end.
Did it feel like actors grandstanding? Because they're all acting big. Maggie Smith less so, perhaps. Well, actually, only Kevin... Actually, that's a complete lie. Only Kevin Kline is acting big.
But I have to say, Kevin Kline is wonderful in this film.
He's wonderful.
He's playing an unpleasant character who actually becomes more unpleasant as the I think that's why the resolution doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that what would happen would happen. I don't think the resolution works because he's become such a... so quickly become such a despicable alcoholic that I didn't find the romance side of it felt genuine.
Well, I just think that, 57 years of melancholy and heartbreak and kind of, this whole...
And his mum as well.
The certain things about his past that are, extremely traumatic. And yet, just a couple of conversations with, the supposed person who could be the cause of it. And all of a sudden it's all okay and lovely and happily ever after.
It does feel a bit pat. It does feel like it hasn't... I think the last... There's some interesting conversations in the middle, as you say. There's some well-written scenes, but it just, in the end, it feels like it's... You're listening to a little bit of whining because the resolution's so quick. It just everybody feels a little bit spoiled, especially as they're given a house.
Necessarily couldn't end the way it does, but that it's too quick in the way it does it.
Okay. All right, we'll be able to quickly move on and we won't have enough time for anything. My Old Lady opened yesterday. Well, not everything, the last two things. My Old Lady opened yesterday and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A for some fruity language. This week, Cambridge can boast that it's now a four-cinema city, as the 130-year-old Divinity School at St John's College plays host to the Cambridge Boutique Cinema Club. Still only a fledgling operation, the Boutique Cinema Club is all about once again making a trip to the cinema and experience. They launched in October last month with a double bill of the Rocky Horror Picture Show and The Shining, with the screenings accompanied by actors and set design that turn familiar films into an evening of ghoulish interactivity. Tonight, if you're listening to the show live on the Saturday, on the 22nd of November, their Christmas double bill is It's a Wonderful Life and Home Alone, with weeks of preparation turning the winding stone corridors of St. John's College into a suitably wintry world. I spoke to the Boutique Club's founding members, Joe Robbins and William Young, about how they put together the boutique experience, how they chose their double bills, and how they hope to bring a bit of razzle-dazzle back to a night at the pictures. But I began by asking William Young where the notion of the Boutique Cinema Club had come from.
Yay! Hello, Bedford Falls! Merry Christmas, movie house! Merry Christmas, Emporium! Merry Christmas, you wonderful old building alone!
The origins of Boutique Cinema Club actually came from myself and Joe going to Camden to see the Backyard Cinema Club. And we just thought that in Cambridge, the clientele is here for something like this to be brought to Cambridge. And secondly, it's something that we ourselves would love to be part of.
The reason for setting up Boutique Cinema Club was to bring sort of the magic back to cinema. So what we're trying to do is give users an experience which they probably wouldn't get from a mainstream cinema. When people come to the venue, that's where the experience starts, not from when they sit down. And then we bring through with actors and other mediums sort of the magic of the films, the cult classics, and they can really enjoy it in that way.
I think Cambridge is the perfect location to start this brand, because you only need to walk into the St. John's Divinity School and see what a fabulous building it is. The cinema room itself is incredible. It is a throwback to cinemas of old.
So you've had The Shining and Rocky Horror, and you're about to have Home Alone and It's a Wonderful Life. Are you surprised at the audiences you're getting? Is there a hankering? Because you're appealing to a younger, to a generation below mine, a generation or two below mine. Is there a hankering to see these films that they haven't seen on the big screen on a relatively large screen?
Yeah, I think that's basically what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to bring the magic to film, to maybe a way that people haven't seen those films before. So we're almost showing them in all of their glory. And especially a film like Rocky Horror Show, to have actors dressed in the Rocky Horror Show theme, to theme the whole venue, it really gets people in the mood. And it brings that film maybe to the next level and does it justice that you couldn't get by ordering it or buying it from FOP as a DVD.
You're sort of going back to that cinema as theatre.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. We're picking the cult films that perhaps are more suited to that as a situation and as a venue, rather than picking films that are traditional cinema-style films where you sit down, everybody's quiet, and just respects it. And the boutique element of it is that the theme doesn't override the film. The film is the main event, and we don't want people to get confused with too many other things going on. We just want it to be an experience from start to finish, all building up, and the culmination is always the film, and that should be taken centre stage for us.
If I Google Boutique Cinema Club, I'm just as likely to find designers or artists who have it on their CV at the moment than I am to find any actual press coverage. So that suggests that there's an awful lot of work goes into the preparation of the one that you've done and the one you're about to do.
We have links with people at Cambridge University, and the people that we saw and that we already knew, we asked them if they'd wanted to be involved, and it just snowballed from there, and we ended up having about 12 actors at the first event, and a couple of makeup artists, and their role in the Divinity School foyer, which is where the reception is beforehand, their role was to mingle in with people and to act and really sort of bring that side of it to life, and then you then walk up the stairs to the main cinema room, and we had actors placed on the stairs all dressed up in Halloween, and that's where it started. The people who are involved have a lot of input into what we do, and it's a collaborative effort. But, you know, the first event was a six-day preparation. We've had a lot bigger run-up to this one, so we can expect some bigger things.
How did you go about choosing the films that you have chosen? So Home Alone and It's a Wonderful Life is an odd double bill. Are they screening one after each other? Yes. Is that the plan? So it's quite a long evening.
The first reception's at 5 p.m. And the night finish around 10:30. And it's staggered between the two films. The way the films were chosen were that we came up with a shortlist with our team of around 12 films. We put them on our website and asked people to vote. And naturally it occurred that Home Alone and It's a Wonderful Life were there. We would say with the first event that we did, choosing Rocky Horror Show and The Shining, we wanted to have one cult film, which was sort of maybe easily themed, which Rocky Horror Show was, and go alongside that a real classic that really captured the Halloween edge to it. And we feel like in this one, It's a Wonderful Life is a very classic film. And Home Alone, especially with the students, and even raging it, we've had parents getting in contact with us saying that this is their favourite Christmas film, this is what gets them in the Christmas spirit.
Coming from Water Sprite, it makes sense to assume that this is, at least at these early stages, primarily a student affair, but and for students only. But you said with Home Alone that you had phone calls from concerned parents that their children wouldn't get a chance to see this Christmas classic.
Well, this is the thing. We want it to be an event that anyone in Cambridge can come to. So obviously we've got great links within the student market in Cambridge, Anglia Ruskin as well, and we've opened it up to them in a big way. But saying that, we're locals ourselves. Our parents came to the first one, and we really want to put something on the map for the Cambridge locals. Obviously at Christmas, when it's this December and the students go home, we're going to look to try and run another one. And that's going to be purely local, local interest only.
There certainly is a growth over the past 2 or 3 years where this immersive experience, or a different experience, cinema in the backyard, as you pointed out earlier, cinema on a roof, or cinema that's been projected from a bicycle-powered projector. It's basically the drive-in model, or the road show. Have you been looking at these models and seeing, or these past business endeavours, these past ideas, and seeing and obviously having many ideas of your own, but sort of picking and choosing what you think would work in this smaller scale?
We are heavily influenced by the drive-in model, because you see the old movies either screened there or within that, people attending them, and there seemed to be a big gulf, especially in this country, between then and now, of that being available to people. So we've taken a lot of inspiration from that. The venue that we have at the Divinity School is 150 capacity per showing. And the feedback that we've had from the first show was that it really gave that exclusive edge. So we are looking to scale. The possibilities are endless. We could go all over the country, but we want to retain that exclusive boutique edge. And that's why we're the boutique cinema club. We're not a secret cinema or just a normal film club. And I think we need to retain that just to make the experience as best that we can.
Many thanks to Joe Robbins and William Young for the interview. You can find out a little more about the Cambridge Boutique Cinema Club from their website, www.boutiquecinemaclub, all stretched as one word, boutiquecinemaclub.co.uk. But it would also be wise to find and follow them on Facebook, which seems to be the best way to keep abreast of the latest screening news, especially with all the plans they have for next year. I have been informed that despite being sold out, tonight's Christmas double bill will have tickets at the door. It's £6.50 per film, which, when you consider all the bells and whistles being laid on, is a very good deal indeed. It's become obvious over the last decade that Turkish director Nuri Ceylan is the master of the slow burn drama. Previous films Climates and Once Upon a Time in Anatolia both ran well over 2 hours, whilst his new film, the Cannes-winning Winter Sleep, runs at over 3 hours. But as Ceylan's films have expanded, their focus is narrowed and refined. Winter Sleep concerns itself almost entirely with the character of Mr. Aidan, a rural hotelier with delusions of grandeur. played by Hallock Billinger as a man who considers himself a big fish willingly swimming in a small pond. An ex-actor who boasts he's never appeared in a soap opera, and with a pomposity that easily matches his wealth, Aidan has aspirations to be the benevolent don to the poor mountain community his luxurious boutique hotel sits outside, proffering platitudes and charity with a boorish grace. Yossi, this is a long film. Winter Sleep is a long film, but I found it fascinating to watch that have this 3+ hour running time to patiently unpick this one personality thread by thread. Did you enjoy that?
I did. It is a long film. I actually read in an interview with Salan that it was supposed to be 4.5 hours originally.
Coward,
but
cutting
it. I know.
Probably the Weinsteins.
Yeah, getting involved again. It's a film that it does demand a lot of patience. It's a slow burner, but it's very much a remarkable film. I really, really, really liked it. This unravelling of this character, Mr. Aidan, is that how you pronounce it, I think? He's such a conceited character, yet there's so much more to him. And some of the sequences, you've got these sequences where he's having a conversation with his sister or with his wife, and it's just a kind of 15-minute long conversation between the two of them. And in those moments, I mean, in any other film, I'd probably be very, very bored watching that because they talk about quite profound ideas.
They're only profound to them.
Yeah, well...
We're pointing out. They're actually quite feeble theorising they're doing, but they think it's brilliant.
They do, and it's partly their delivery, isn't it? It's just, I was swept up in it. And normally I hate films that are over 3 hours long. I get very restless and I get very bored, but I was completely involved in this. It's a very well-constructed film. It's beautifully shot. The performances are fantastic. I loved it.
Jack, I found it, certainly for the first 2.5 hours, it then stretches its legs a little bit as a narrative, but I found it almost a Dickensian brilliance, grandeur in this central character. It reminded me of those bumbling, self-important fools that think the world is at their feet, but really they're at the bottom of the barrel. It reminded me of that. It had that sort of brilliance to it. How did you find it? Because you saw it some time ago, I think.
Yeah, well, I queued twice for this film at Cannes and I missed it both times. And so I spent about 4.5 hours in a queue to try and see this film in the sunshine. Didn't see it. But then I actually saw it in the rain at the London Film Festival. And it's far more autumnal and wintry a film, not to be obvious with the film title. I think Aidan is both protagonist and antagonist. And if I'm honest, I didn't really like him. I found it was just depressing to watch this white male supremacy thing play out. And he's got so much and... He seems to... It is, as you say, Dickensian. He doesn't seem to think about the hardships of his tenants.
He has no self-awareness. He thinks he's all self-awareness and all giving, but he doesn't realise that charity starts at home. He's thinking of throwing money at this distant charity that he's had in a letter, partly to impress his wife, but he's completely unaware...
His tenant not being able to pay rent 1 month. And he makes that poor little boy kiss his hand and then the boy's face is so wrought with anger and emotion and betrayal. And
it's not the fact that he makes the boy kiss his hand. It's the fact he pretends he doesn't want it. I think that's one thing the length gives you. Again, I sometimes wonder that some art house sort of gets these lengths of, is easily forgiven for this length of running time. But it's the little details. It's the fact the only power he has in this film is his constant asking for cups of tea. I love that, the way that builds up the culminative effect of just this, oh, can I have a cup of tea? And as if it's nothing, but it's the only command he has at his power.
Well, credit to New Wave Films, the UK distributor, because we're just really lucky to have a distributor like that in the UK that is willing to pick up these long, long films. They recently did, is it Naught or Naughty?
Naughty,
which is 4.5 hours.
Masterpiece.
Like, how hard is it to get a film of this length into the cinema, regardless of it being a Palme d'Or winner? And interestingly, last year, Blue is the Warmest Colour, an equally lengthy film, very different subject matter. But, it's one of the main positive things about the Cannes Film Festival is that when they award this Palme d'Or, a film like this, which may have really struggled to have any impact in the UK film scene, just comes at it with this beautiful kind of garland.
Any sort of marketing hook, which is the role these festivals, especially Cannes, these festivals play. Same with Leviathan and its London Film Festival win. Mm. Another brilliant, brilliant but long film. Did you find that it weakened at all when it does stretch its legs? Because despite it, the film being provisionally about him and his wife, his much younger wife, that is sort of stuck in this Back of Beyond location, there's no scene between them for 2 hours, I don't think.
Mm.
And then she becomes a central figure for a while. Did you find that weak in the film, or was it an important element? Because it slightly proves that he has a point in one of his earlier scenes. It actually enriches his character a little bit.
Yes, I some of my favourite parts of the film were involving the wife character. I think she is the tool that really demonstrates what's wrong with his character in certain senses. I think that she was very much important, and I don't think her bits weakened. The only part where I was a bit like, oh, was the bit where she goes to visit one of his tenants. That part was the only part of the film that I felt wasn't as strong as the rest of it.
That does sort of echo a little bit. I haven't had time to really... It hasn't fully percolated through, because obviously both of us came out of a screening at 12 o'clock last night. But that sort of echoes what he says earlier on when he's bullying her, when he's being passive-aggressive, when he says, you don't really know what you're doing with your charitable causes. Mm. And you're on her side there. And then she does do something that's foolish.
Yeah,
she does give Bernard Cribbins the money, and Bernard Cribbins refuses it. This is a Railway Children reference. Which, it's the same scene, basically. Sorry. That's what came to my mind watching Winter Sleep, the Railway Children.
And it's funny as well, isn't it, in parts?
Oh, yeah, I laughed.
You know, when the window gets broken, it's not plot spoiler here, and him and his handyman, they're having a talk. It's like, well, what kind of window do you want? Do you want a European window or a Turkish one?
We want a brand window. Where are you going to buy a brand window in this godforsaken spot?
Where they get the slippers for the amount. And it's just, there are bits where I laughed. It's a very complex film, and it is very bleak in places. But it did, you know, there are comedic bits as well. And I think all round, I just think everyone should see it. I think it's great.
It is brilliant. I imagine, Jack, that it has about one screening a day for that length.
Yeah, we can only fit it in one screen a day, but it got a good occupancy last night. It was about almost half full.
Everybody stayed with it till the end. No, I think it is over 3 hours, but it runs by very quickly. You know, it is.
It didn't feel long.
No.
Well, it felt long, but not.
No, but it isn't tiring. It's more drag sitting through parts of the Caribbean, two and a half hours. Anyway, as has just been said, Winter Sleep opened yesterday and is screening, I think, as only once a day at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15. That is all we have time for this morning. The last hour, after some extra ingredients have been thrown in, will soon be available as a podcast, available to either stream from the Cambridge 105 website or to download via our iTunes page. You can follow us on social networking for all the details. We will not be back in a fortnight's time because of the Mill Road Winter Fair, which Cambridge 105 is broadcasting from. Our final show of the year, therefore, will be on the 20th of December, when we should be, if all goes to plan, our top 10 favourite films of the year. And you'll be able to vote for your own top 5 in the Take One Bums on Seats Picture House quiz, which is Monday week. We will play out with some of Bernard Herrmann's iconic score for Hitchcock's masterpiece Vertigo, which is screening in 70mm at the Arts Picture House on the 27th of November. In my most tutorial voice, you should go see it. You'd be a fool to miss it. Please stay tuned for Best of the Guests, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.